What is up, world? It is Mark here, back with another episode of The Sensory Corner, a podcast surrounding all conversations, sensory, parenting, and occupation related. My name is Mark. I'll be your host for today, and this podcast is being brought to you guys by Senso Minds. The whole reason why I'm holding this podcast is because I've been holding various conversations with OTs, SLPs, sensory parents, and even just specialists and mental health therapists within the sensory or special needs realm. And I hope that by sharing these conversations, we can have a much more well-rounded discussion and a much more healthier discourse on what it's like to be a child living in a world with sensory or special needs. And most importantly, how exactly do they learn, grow, and develop? Hopefully by the end of these podcasts, we together as a community can help children better integrate into the world around them. But anyways, that's enough for me. My name is Mark. I'll be your host for today, and this is the Sensory Corner. So for today's topic, we're going to be talking about something super simple. We're going to be going over coloring and writing. Yep, you heard me right, folks. Coloring and writing. Okay, wait, pause. Before you parents and OTs tune out of this podcast, I was kidding. I get it. These are functional activities which children are bound to do either at home or at school. And sometimes they can be extremely boring and monotonous, and we've all done them before, and you're wondering, okay, what the hell can Mark teach me about coloring and writing? I promise you it's not, because of the fact that we're now entering a space where we're all going into telehealth, we're all going into teletherapy, and children are now going into remote learning with their classrooms. How exactly do you spruce up these activities and keep them engaged, and more so, keep them on top of their developmental milestones and all the skills they need to learn? Well, to help us out with this podcast, we brought on an OT. Her name is Andrea Dumar. She's the owner of the OT Room. Has tons of DIY, sensory resources, and more so, little ideas you can do at home. And she'll be showing us how exactly can we spruce up these tabletop activities to provide another dimension of benefit for the child, but also keep them engaged. But anyways, that's enough for me. Let's just jump right into the podcast.
So in the academic setting, a lot of it is the fine motor and visual motor aspects related to the handwriting, the visual motor in the sense of can they copy from a paper in front of them that the teacher gives them, or if the teacher is writing on the board, can they copy straight from the board from their seat? Can they see that far away and make sure their handwriting is legible? Are they copying all the information correctly? Also in the same sense, their classroom routine. Are they able to follow the simple directions of going to hang their backpack, lunchbox, jacket up in the cubby, take off their jacket on and off? Are they going to the bathroom? Are they having trouble with their buttons? Topics like that. Their attention within the classroom. Are they able to sit and attend? Do they need various means of wobble seats, a standing desk, things like that?
Okay. For children, that seems like a lot.
You know, yeah.
Even just hearing all that from me, I don't know if I could. I'm pretty sure I could meet all those standards. I'm probably not
getting big realm.
Yes. So where do you usually start with children? Because that's a whole slew of things you expect from them to learn within a year. Is that the time frame?
Well, you make some goals. Some obviously they'll meet, and some might be longer goals that are going to take a little bit longer. So it's working up to them. Sometimes you can start a goal at, say, moderate assistance, that you're helping them quite hands-on, and then slowly and slowly you reduce it to minimal assistance, okay, less hands-on, but you're still there to independent. So it's, you can have the same goal, but then reduce the assistance and how much verbal cues you need.
So you stated you worked as an outpatient before being a school OT, correct? Or outpatient or inpatient?
Outpatient.
So how exactly does that differ? Because with an outpatient, you're dealing one-on-one. Is that correct or no?
When I did it, it was one-on-one.
Yes.
And then in the school, I do one-on-one and sometimes small group.
Okay. So it's not dealing with all the children at once.
No, never.
No, it's not.
I don't do full classroom sessions.
Interesting. So working in those small group sessions, what exactly does a day in the life for Andre Dumar look like?
So my typical day is waking up, getting to school, and then a lot of the students on my caseload are preschool, whether they have autism, just developmental delays. It's going in. I take them from the classroom. They come to the OT room. If some of the students have trouble transitioning, then I will push into the classroom. A lot of the times the teachers are very welcoming. They always are glad to have extra hands in the classroom working with a student. And They'll come to my room. We'll sometimes do some gross motor activities just to get a warm up before we go to the tabletop. And then again, do some tabletop activities like fine motor cutting, coloring, painting before taking a break. Mm-hmm. You learn your best when you're not sitting for 30 minutes straight. So it's trying to break up those activities and space it out. Then 30 minute sessions, I see my student, take them back, go get another student. See them for 30 minutes, work with them, take them back, and it continues throughout the day. And then at the end of the day, I have my prep time, which that's when I usually get all my documentation done. Mm-hmm. One day a week, I use most of my day to evaluate students. So any pending evals or IPs that I have upcoming, one day a week, I always work on all of them.
Interesting. So side thought, you're almost like the fun parent or the fun teacher who comes in and pulls children out. Do they look forward to seeing you walk in?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
some
they
of them
do.
Walk into the classroom and they lose that. Are you taking me? Are you taking me? And then some of them are so upset. Like my one student the other day, I pulled one student and then the other one was sitting there and I could see he was getting like ready to cry. And I was like, don't cry. I'm going to come back. I'm seeing him. And then I was like, don't cry. But then I was like, if you cry, I can't see you. You have to like listen to the teacher. I can't take you. So then you like see him turn his head and he's like wiping. He's like, like deep breaths. Like, I was like, I'm not going to do it.
Like funny. Did you end up taking him?
Like, I'm like, did you cry? And he's like, no, I didn't.
Tears streaming down his face. Yeah. No.
Like, no, I'm not doing it. I'm watching you. Don't cry.
Did you ever end up bringing him into your room or no?
Yeah, I came. He was my second one, but it's like, okay, they all want to go right as soon as they see me.
A part of me was like, did she lead him on? Did she just lead on a pre-K student into an OT session? Awesome. So you said during your sessions, you do a lot of table work, a lot of painting, writing, anything else? Sorry, I'm not sure if I missed anything. What were the key?
Painting, cutting, coloring, stringing beads, puzzles, things like that.
Okay. So you try your best to keep table work as fun as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much of a struggle is that? Especially with high energy, you know, very hyperactive children. That's what I'm assuming. Maybe you might be blessed.
It varies. Person to person. You get the ones who just don't want to sit because they have a lot of energy, or you get the ones who are just lazy and they just don't want to work, whether it's at the table or on the floor. So you kind of see them.
Okay, so how do you deal with both of those parties? Because it seems like they just don't want to do the table work. They don't want to be at the table. How do you entice them to do the work at the table or just do the work in general?
Motivation of, well, if you do your work now, you get to pick the game. What game do you want to do next? Okay, let's work for that game. When you finish this, we can take a break. Whatever break you want, that's what we'll do.
Okay. But if they see the toys, sorry, I'm just drilling you right now, but if they see the toys in the corner or they see something fun, aside from the table work, how exactly do you deal with them being distracted?
Usually they, like, sometimes when they'll walk in, they'll look around, want touch, but then, like, if you're stern and then you say, first we have to do this, then you can pick, and then you, like, I'll bring the game over with us. Okay, you do this worksheet, then we'll play Pop the Pig, whatever.
And interesting.
They usually listen. They're not. Sometimes I have the aides there with me. So, like, if there are super duper distracted, the aides assist in bringing them to the table.
Okay. You said you bring the game to the table sometimes.
Yeah, if that's what they need.
Yeah. Are there any times?
Just go in front of them.
Yes. Are there any times where you have to bring the exercises over to them?
In some cases, but.
Some cases. So.
Usually.
A topic which has come up a lot within just the overall educational realm is this whole idea of active seating. Just the fact that with very hyperactive children, or just children with a lot of energy in general, they really need to move in order to focus. Do you utilize any types of active seating? And what does that look like in your practice? How exactly do you leverage it to your best of your ability?
So I have both the therapy balls and then the wobble seats within the OT room. So if we are doing something at the table, I can utilize them, but also at the same sense, sometimes the wobble seat can become a distraction where that's all they're focused on is rocking and back and forth. So you have to try to find a balance of what's working for the student or what's becoming a distraction. And also if we're doing tabletop work, if I start seeing that they're becoming fatigued or more distracting, then that's when we can either take a break or just depends. I'll do the activity then on the floor, do something else to change up the environment so it gets them refocused, redirected.
Awesome. So what are the main benefits behind implementing active seating though? Because you mentioned a lot of downfalls, not downfalls, but things which can go wrong, especially, you know, if the child isn't focusing, they're focusing too much on rocking back and forth, they might get tired. Are there any upsides to utilizing active seating which you've seen in your practice?
Well, it's very beneficial to increase attention. So some students need that movement. They need that support. Okay. So for those students, it works on increasing the attention and it's getting them, their body more regulated so they can sit and do the work. So that's when the wobble seats are good also in the classroom, or in some cases you use the standing desks in the classroom. So it's increasing attention, but also giving the child the movement that they might be seeking.
Movement that they might be seeking. Is that more so for sensory reasons or is that for muscle development reasons or both?
It could be both, but a lot of times that one, I would say, falls more under the sensory seeking aspects.
Sensory seeking. So you mainly keep active seating within your classroom or within your practice to satisfy those sensory processes of these children. I think it's vestibular, is that correct? Or proprioceptive? I don't know.
It would actually be both vestibular and proprioceptive.
Ah, okay. That makes a lot more sense.
So I know before we had this podcast chat, you were bringing up various positions you get children to do, various activities, aside from just being at the table. Kind of slipped my mind. What does that exactly look like in your practice? Because that was the first time I've ever heard of that, bringing table work off of the table.
So to bring the table work off of the table, sometimes I like to tape a picture of whatever picture we're doing. So like St. Patrick's Day just passed, I'll tape a shamrock to the wall and then we'll color on the wall. So I tape it right there and then the child can either do it standing, sitting on a therapy ball, or we'll do it kneeling. And we'll do that right on the wall. I'll bring the crayons, markers, whatever materials we need, and we'll sit facing the wall, and that's how we'll do our activity for the day. It helps give them some movement as well as strengthen some extra muscles in their bodies. And it's a change of just sitting at the table. You know, sitting at the table gets boring for a while.
No, definitely. Do they look forward to doing those things? Because children are smart. Sometimes they realize, you know what, this is dumb. I'm not doing this. Has that ever happened to you, or do they just buy into it 100%
of the time? They think it's funny, like, why am I facing the wall? Or some of the worksheets I have, it's like, oh, roll a dice and what number is on the dice. So now it's like multiple aspects. Instead of just sitting there coloring, it's like, we're rolling a dice now, count the dice. Now let's find that number on the picture. So it's not just sitting there boring coloring. It's now we're doing multiple activities in one without even realizing.
Does changing up the positioning ever get buy-in for children then? Because at all of these topics you're bringing up, these are things which have been brought up by other OTs. We want to be able to develop visual processing. We want to develop fine motor at the same time, but oftentimes it just doesn't work at the table. So does doing it on the wall help you get buy-in from the children so you can get the task done or no?
Sometimes it's more enjoyable because now, okay, like if you're sitting on the therapy ball, now you get some bouncing, you get some rocking in instead of just sitting in a non-moving chair.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Wow. That was the first that I've ever heard of activities being done on a wall. I love it. Are there any other things you do on the wall besides? Yeah, we didn't really go into what practices are appropriate for the wall. This is totally new to me. I'm still trying to wrap my head around how you're able to figure this out. So what worksheets do you usually put up during your practice?
So I'll do like a coloring worksheet. So just color the picture of a simple picture, do some mazes, try to have them go through the maze on the wall. Or like I said, it's like a color and roll. So roll the dice, count how many. If you rolled 5 on the dice, we'll now find number 5 on the picture and color that shamrock. Roll the dice, find the next number, and color it on the picture. So you can adapt whatever kind of worksheet. Just we'll do some simple just writing on the worksheet. Today I had them just write the letters, go back and forth, find the letter and write the letter, find the letter, write the letter. So you're working on different senses and sensory, getting various means of sensory input as you're doing the activity, whether you're changing your position in space from looking down at the floor to back up at the wall, or also getting some proprioceptive as you're bouncing and rocking on the ball and coloring on the wall. You're getting sensory feedback through your hands, your whole body.
Besides just sensory feedback, though, are there any physiological or physical benefits to doing these practices aside from being hunched over on a table? Especially during those early stages, you said you were dealing with pre-K students, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So their muscles are still developing. What does that look? What do these exercises help those children with physiologically?
So working on the vertical surface helps further develop the shoulder muscles and wrist stability that you would need for all your writing tasks. And you're trying to further develop those muscles so as the student gets older, they're not complaining of their hands being tired, their hands are cramping up, just fatiguing in general. So working on the vertical surface, you're trying to really strengthen all those muscles in the arm and the wrist, similar to how if you were working at the table, you would just put a slant board, or a cheaper version is using a binder. It's the same concept, just on the wall.
Is there a, this is for the parents listening, is there a progression which a parent should go through in order to get their child to be able to write on the wall? I don't know if I'm wording that correctly. Is there a way a parent can work their way up to getting their child to that point of writing on a wall? Or can they just throw their child straight into, you know, a worksheet taped onto a wall?
I mean, depending on the age of the child, like they can just stick a giant piece of poster board. Like if they're young, even just learning to hold a pencil, or I mean a crayon, just put it on the wall and let them scribble over it. The whole arm will be going. So when the younger you are, you're working on the whole arm movements. And then as you get older, you further progress to the more refined and just moving the forearm, then the wrist. And then eventually you can hone in on doing just smaller worksheets. But when they're younger, you want use a big just poster.
Big movements.
That's fine because you don't want to do a little piece of paper and then now your wall is completely covered in scribbles.
So I can see
the level where my kids are at is that we're stabilizing the paper with our helper hand and then trying to stay in the lines as we color. But for some kids, yeah, you get the whole scribbles, but we're working up towards developing the muscles, trying to increase our strength to eventually get to the smaller areas.
Interesting. So this is just a key note for all the parents out there. Make sure you buy a lot of primer and paint here to do these exercises at home.
Just make sure you're providing them with some supervision.
Yes. That's really... I love that approach, just building up the foundational muscles and skills so that they can work their way up to, you know, those more fine motor, refined hand motor skills, which are really needed for actual writing, you know, from pincer grasp to tripod grasp. I don't know if there's any other types of which they're, like, are those the main ones? That's more so just for me.
Mm-hmm. Pincer and tripod are the two big ones. Pincer just using these, and then tripod is what? You would want to see how they hold the pencil. There's other types of pinches, but those
are the main
the main ones that we look for while working in the school and everyday life.
Yes. I think one of the main concerns which came up for me, but you answered it, was I was coming at it from the perspective that you should focus on the fine motor and then work your way up to the big muscles. Because I was afraid that if a child was to go straight into a wall activity, they would hold, the viewers can't see this, but it's basically holding a marker with a full-on fist. No pincer grasp, no paint, just a full-on fist.
That's and they're the just scribbling on the wall. Developmental stage of the grasp.
Interesting.
Because so first you hold it as a fist, and that would be the palmar grasp. And then you do the digital pronate where now your thumb's facing down and your pinky's up. And that's how you color. And then eventually you go to like just two finger pinch and then eventually, or kind of like a four. And then eventually it goes to the tripod where like these fingers are tucked in.
Wow. I didn't even know.
Realistically, no one has the perfect tripod grasp. A lot of kids have the thumb wrap, or even adults have the thumb wrap, the awkward hand up hot, finger up high. But you try to hope the tripod's what we're going to get.
Yes. You just try and approach it as best as you can.
A lot of the grasps come from weak hands and weak fingers, weak arms. That's when you start seeing the funky grasps on pencils, because they're compensating because they have weak hands and weak grip strength. Mm-hmm.
That's so weird. I'm looking back as to how I developed my way of handwriting as a kid. I don't think I ever drew on a wall. I don't think I ever scribbled. I was just thrown in to just straight up handwriting, just do this drill over and over again. And I don't know how I was able to compensate over time. I don't even know if I'm writing properly up until this point. So just hearing these developmental stages with writing, it really does provide parents out there who are listening to this a better perspective as to how they can keep up with their child and not really push them out of their boundaries or past their comfort level, but more so just working alongside with them till they get comfortable to move on to the next step.
Well, especially nowadays when you're supposed to know and be able to do so much more than developmentally appropriate. So like now by kindergarten, you're supposed to be writing sight words and sentences and stories with beginning, middle, and end. When I was back in kindergarten, I was still just learning my ABCs.
Right?
Now, and even a child doesn't establish hand dominance until between 5 to 6 years old. Now, going into kindergarten, you're 4 or 5, and you turn either 5 or 6. Uh-huh. And you're expected to already know and be able to write all your letters. When developmentally, you're probably unsure which hand you're even is your dominant one.
Is that concerning to hear? Like, is that concerning to see that shift within the, I don't even want to say industry, within the OT therapist or educational space?
I would say it is concerning. But it's what, I don't make the rules, and someone's saying that these are what the kids are supposed to be doing, so it's only trying to help them keep up with it.
Who's saying this? What's their number? Where's their address? I want to find them.
Develop the curriculum. They're pushing this too hard of curriculum that's just not appropriate.
But children are able to keep up? What's happening with them?
Well, now you're starting to see the funky grasp.
Wow. The
letters not being formed correctly. Mm-hmm.
And they're really leaning on you guys, the OTs, to correct these things when they might not even be developmentally or intellectually or cognitively at that stage yet.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't even know that. That just took a turn. I didn't.
We don't learn how to draw a triangle till 6 years old. But if you think about it, an A is almost like a triangle. So F. 4 or 5 when you're in kindergarten trying to write and you can't make a triangle, how are you going to be able to write a letter A?
That is so true. It seems those shapes are foundational towards a lot of the letters which children
can't
learn
write letters
up into
if
this.
You don't know your pre-writing strokes and pre-writing shapes.
Pre-writing strokes as in like vertical lines.
Yeah, diagonal.
Horizontal lines. Diagonal lines.
Go up and down, zigzag.
Mm-hmm. I remember hearing this from somewhere, crossing midline. I forgot which conversation that was. What boggled my mind was the fact that for me, crossing midline, for all the viewers out there who don't know what crossing midline is, it means, correct me if I'm wrong, Andre, it's when you draw a horizontal line which crosses from your right extremity if you're right-handed over to your left extremity. So you cross your midline of your body. I didn't know children did this, but they can't do that. Some of them can't. What they'll do is they'll draw one line up into the midline, and then they'll put it into the other hand, and then they'll draw the line to connect it. Is that what usually happens? Why does that happen? I don't get that. I don't understand why children do that.
Because they're not reaching all the way over. They're stopping and switching hands. So a lot of the times, if they don't necessarily have a hand dominance or even hand preference, they'll just reach to whatever. If you put something on their left side, well, now they're going to reach with their left hand. If you put something on the right side, now they're going to reach with their right hand. So so now you're telling them to draw two lines across. Well, I need to go left, so let me use my left hand. Now I need to draw a line on the right, let me use my right hand.
Wow. That's That's so funky to me. I don't, but I don't know if this is the right line of thinking then, but it seems like those very large foundational movements, very large muscular movements can come into play here and really benefit the child. I don't know if that's the right way to think about it, because if a child is used to making those big movements and is already naturally crossing midline, would that benefit them? Or is that something you just need to drill over and over again as an OT dealing with handwriting in children?
Well, you hope even at a young age that the parents are working on crossing midline and reaching for, like, if they're a baby, learning to sit up, put items in front of them and try to have them reach for it. And then put it a little bit slanted, so now they're reaching outside of their base of support and crossing midline, so that they're developing the skill of crossing midline early on. So then when it comes to skills down the road, they're already crossing midline, and you're working on the different core strength, arm strength, all of them into play.
Interesting. So on that same topic of, you know, child development, especially in those early on stages when they're even a toddler, and on top of that, being able to develop all those foundational muscle groups, the core strength, you know, the shoulder stability, maybe even forearm strength. I know that kind of ties into the finger strength as well, so I'm not sure if that's going too distally. Are there any other positions which you could recommend to parents with respect to doing table work? Anything you utilize in your practice to further engage those muscles, further engage those sensory processes, and really help a child in their development?
So another position, instead of doing at the table or on the wall, would be just coloring on their stomach. Okay. Putting an act, even not even just coloring, whether it's a puzzle or a board game, just doing any activities on their stomach is really beneficial to further work on the head, neck, and core muscles that they're going to need. Because now they're laying on their stomach, they're trying to prompt up on their arms, and now they have to work on themselves to hold their head up, their neck up. Can they hold their, are their arms supported, or are they dropping their head between their arms? Mm-hmm. Are they trying to compensate by rolling onto their side? Are they only able to lay on their stomach for a few minutes, even seconds, before they're trying to get up and reposition themselves? Mm-hmm. So that's another good position to work on different skills in, to help strengthen your body before you're getting further to handwriting tasks such as full writing paragraph sentences. Mm-hmm. If you're not, don't have any neck, head, core, arm strength, well, now you're getting older and you're complaining your hands are tired, your wrists are tired, mm-hmm. or you're just having trouble with your writing.
Interesting.
So coloring on your stomach all comes back to tummy time as a baby. The tummy time is so important to help further develop those muscles, get stronger, right as a baby.
Yeah. It's weird they bring that up, because parents are so eager to get their children out of that crawling phase. They just want them to learn how to walk. It's like, it's those videos you see on AFE. I don't know if I'm dating myself. They're America's Funniest Videos, where the child's like walking over to their parent, saying like the mom's name, but not the dad's name. Anyways, that was a complete tangent. Parents are so eager to get their children to learn how to walk, but they don't really understand the importance of those gross movements during tummy time, during those crawling stages. Mm-hmm.
You don't want to skip the crawling stage, because crawling is just as important as tummy time, because it still incorporates the position of head in space. Are you able to hold your head up?
Wow. You're
strengthening your shoulders, and as you're pushing through your arms as you're trying to crawl.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever see... Actually, let me rephrase this question. When you deal with children of whom are coloring on their stomachs and they can't hold up those positions for prolonged periods of time, and what I mean by that is they can't hold it for 2 minutes or a minute, say, and you realize, okay, this child's neck and core muscles, they're not developed, they're not strong enough. Obviously, you can't turn your OT session into a PE class, right? You can't make them do sit-ups in the middle of a handwriting task. So how exactly do you build that up in a child?
So you want to strengthen the muscles through other ways. So by doing an obstacle course, that could be one way you're trying to strengthen the muscles without them realizing you're even working on it. So you can set up obstacle courses throughout the the OT room or even as a parent at home. You could set up various obstacle courses using those cushions, crawling under the living room table to try to strengthen those muscles. And for the child, it becomes like a game. It's not necessarily, oh, I'm working. Mom's making me, or the OT's making me sit here and color.
Mm-hmm. So do you expect a lot of the pre-work to be done on behalf of the parents before they enter your pre-K practice? Or do you find yourself trying to work through a lot of those deficits because they weren't worked on? And I'm not placing blame on the parents. That's not what this is about. Because I don't think my parents did a lot of these things, a lot of these activities with myself even. I don't hold that against them. But do you find yourself having to work on these foundational skills before you can buckle down on what you were actually supposed to focus in on, which is, it seems like, handwriting, you know, scissoring, painting, or is that just something you integrate within your practice every
I think
now
it's
then?
All integrated as a whole, whether I'm doing it, the parent does it, either or. And there's different factors that go into each child of why they might have some weakness, whether they have low tone or just a whole lot of different factors that go into each child of why they might be having some weakness compared to another child. So it's not something you necessarily work on every session. We're doing this strengthening, this strengthening, this strengthening. It's trying to break it up throughout sessions that we're increasing our hand strength, our shoulder strength, all of it, whether it's in one little task or a big task. It's constantly in the school setting, you're trying to strengthen those hands so they're going to be the most successful back in the classroom.
Yes. So it's more so from a holistic perspective. Mm-hmm. As a whole. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yes, it's encouraged to do tummy time and crawling at home.
Yeah.
And that's where it should start because you want to set the foundation.
Yes.
So now you're setting the foundation at home and then in the school it's getting carried over.
Okay.
So like So like after they progress from crawling, it's like, okay, wow, they're done. They're walking. Great. But you want to keep going. You don't want to ever stop. You always want to strengthen, especially when a child is so young. Because if a child is not getting enough tummy time and not getting enough of the crawling that they learn, then it might cause them, not necessarily all the times. They could, sometimes we do see the difficult with fine motor or the hand-eye coordination. They might have some weakness there, which then comes into play in the classroom. So then now you're already setting them up that they have to know how to write ABCs before even getting there. But now they might have some trouble. They might know their ABCs, but they might have trouble writing it, using both hands together to do a task.
Wow. It's heartbreaking to see sometimes because I hear often that you should meet the child where they are and not force them out of their comfort zone necessarily. Obviously, you want to be able to push them, but you want to be able to meet them where they're at. However, with an education system, which is so, you know, it's go, go, go. It's do this, do this, do this, learn this, learn this, learn this. It's very hard for children to keep up, it seems like, from this conversation. And it's a lot of work to place on you to be able to develop these skills in such a short time period or time frame when a child might not have those skills developed because of practices of which they may have lacked as a child or as a toddler. I guess for parents out there listening into this podcast or even other OTs, what are the main things you look at in order to determine whether or not a child has poor core strength, poor neck strength, poor shoulder strength and stability? Just so parents out there can have a bit more bearings as to how they can navigate the world with their child. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, when they're sitting up, are they slouching forward? Are their shoulders coming rounded in because they're falling over? Are they constantly falling over while they're sitting in their chair? When they are on their stomach or in quadruped, is their head dropping? Like they bring it up and then is it dropping back between their arms again? So those are different ones to look at, the core and head strength.
Yeah. With respect to poor fine motor strength, are there things which you should look out for there? Because it becomes a very hard distinction as to whether or not the child just doesn't know how to hold on to the pencil or if they're trying to compensate for poor fine motor strength in their fingers.
Before I do any coloring, I always try to do some type of hand strengthening just as a little practice. Okay. Just always a little extra because
to warm up
your
hands.
You always want
to
have strong hands. You always want to warm up your hands mm-hmm. to keep it going. And then that could be whether do they not know? Do they never learn how to hold the pencil correctly? Or is it the weakness? So that's what you need. That's what working with them, you're able to assess and identify.
Okay. Does that fall on the parents, or would you say that they should probably consult with an OT to figure out those deficits? Is it something they can nip in the bud and more so?
Some parents just don't even know about OT or
really
I've never heard about early intervention. Cause like growing up before I met someone who got OT growing up, I never even knew what OT was. Mm-hmm. Even like when I was younger, I needed speech therapy. My mom never even heard of early intervention. She never heard of it. Most mm-hmm. parents don't. So unless you know someone or have heard about it, sometimes you just don't know. So it's mm-hmm. not necessarily like blame is on anyone. It's just, you don't know, you've never heard of it.
But I remember talking to a few parents and they just, the main concern they had was they didn't know, like you don't know what you don't know. So you can't bring up a concern if you don't even know if that's a concern to begin with.
But anyways, well, that's a concern which is shared by several parents I've talked to over these past few weeks. I'm going to save that for another episode. But to wrap everything up for this podcast,
are there any key takeaways you would want parents to leave with after this conversation's all wrapped up? Anything you'd want them to know based on these different positions or things which they should take home for their child?
You're proactive with your child and you try to work with them the best you can and try to make it fun for them. Coloring on the wall. Wow, look, I'm coloring on the wall. This is crazy. Or coloring on the floor. Like, make it fun. Get them mm-hmm. involved instead of just kids don't want to sit at the table. They don't want, most kids find coloring boring. Make it fun. Do some painting. Do puzzle. Do mazes. Do anything other and try to make it fun for the child so that it's really enjoyable. And then you're building strength and giving them any sensory input they might need without them even realizing.
Awesome. Thank you so much for summing up everything into a nice little cohesive pack of information for the parents to take away at the end of this podcast. Anyways, that wraps up everything. Thank you so much for joining us on today's talk. It was a pleasure having you. Anyways, my name is Mark. I was your host for today, and this was the Sensory Corner. Have a good night, guys. You've just been tuned into the Sensory Corner, a podcast surrounding all conversations sensory, parenting, and occupation related. My name is Mark. I was your host for today, and this podcast is being brought to you guys by Senso Minds. Senso Minds is dedicated to designing and developing new, fun, and engaging sensory stimulating toys for your child to be able to gain the sensory stimulation they need to best integrate into the world around them. If you're curious and want to learn more, want to buy one of our sensory kits, sensory chew necklaces, or even our weighted blankets, be sure to search us up or go to our website via www.sensominds.com. Or give us a follow on our social media handles via Facebook, Instagram, or Pinterest by simply typing in Senso Minds. That's SENSOMINDS. If you liked what you hear and you like the information on this podcast, be sure to give us a little subscribe by hitting that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. And also, leave us a 5-star review. It really does help us increase our reach and helps us connect with more SLPs, more OTs, and more sensory parents of whom will benefit from the information of which is being dished out on these podcasts when we bring on these specialists to talk to. Anyways, that's all for me. My name is Mark, signing out. This is the Sensory Corner.